We're in Zechariah chapter 10. We went through verse 5 last week. So as we start on verse 6, this is more, again, the promise of restoration of his people. We began us talking about the latter rain, which is a spring rain, by the way, which is interesting. We talk about this Sunday morning in our men's Sunday school class, and that spring rain is not the normal rainy season. So when he used that term latter rain, which translates spring rain, the point of that is it is an unusual occurrence. You know, they're like us. We have what? We have El Nino who comes through here and brings a lot of moisture and stuff when it comes through here, and we get our summer monsoons and stuff. Israel is a little bit different. They get their rains in late fall and in the wintertime. And then their winds change, and the winds come up again from the south like there. But they don't have anything to the south of them. Remember, to them, their main water source is over here. So when the prevailing winds come this way, that's their rainy season. When the latter rain, time of the latter rain, the prevailing winds come like this, like our El Nino does. But there's nothing there to catch. Okay? So so the point of this is it's an unusual time. And he talks about this spiritually and talks about it, that the Holy Spirit is going to move upon his people in a time that's not expected. And it ties in with what Jesus even talked about at church. In a time that you least expect, that's when the Son of Man will return. Like a thief in the night, that's when he'll come. You know, all the kind of word terms that tie into that. So that's what he's talking about. So now we come to verse 6. And he says, I will strengthen the house of Judah and I will save the house of Joseph. House of Judah would include here's Judah, the southern kingdom. House of Joseph would include, would be referenced to the northern kingdom. Because remember, who are the sons of Joseph?
Ephraim
and Manasseh. And how many times have you heard, as you read through here, Ephraim has been used by itself to refer to the northern kingdoms. Israel, okay, Jacob, Ephraim, and now Joseph all refer to the northern kingdom. So he ties it back together here, saying Judah, which is the southern kingdom, Joseph, which represents the northern kingdom. Look what he says: I will bring them back. Now, certainly this is prophetic, but when Zechariah wrote this, they were back in the land, right? But you'll remember that the northern kingdom was still dispersed. Okay. After the Assyrians overthrew the northern kingdom, they really never came back. All right. That's why they got the misnomer, the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Okay. So, I think he's not talking about that time. After the crucifixion, the resurrection of Christ, some 30 years after that, or maybe closer to 40 years after that, in AD 70, the Romans came down. Under Titus, he was a general at that time, and he destroyed, and it was his intent to completely annihilate the Jews. That's why at the end of that battle, you have the great battle that many of you may be familiar with, the battle that took place. It really wasn't a battle, Masada, which was the last refuge. Now Masada, we many of us have been there. Masada actually is the winter palace of Herod. He built it as a winter palace, and it's up on this cliff. And there's no easy way to get to Masada. It overlooks the Dead Sea, and even today you can stand on Masada looking down below. With what, I don't know how low the Dead Sea is. It's just tremendously low. You're on Masada. You're on a mountain, but you're still below sea level. Okay, then the Dead Sea is below you.
It's like 1900 feet.
Yeah,
below.
So you're there, and you can look up there, and you can see where the Romans had built stone walls and encampments all the way around the base of Masada, and that wasn't to keep people out. It was to keep the Jews in. Anybody who tried to escape from Masada would be killed. And then what they did is they built a ramp. They kept. So they take their battering rams up there. And you can still see the ramp. You can look right over the thing and see the ramp that they built some 2,000 years ago right there. And the story of Masada is they finally broke through the wall, the gates to get in there and stuff. And when they did, what they found was everybody in Masada was dead. and they found little shards of pottery that had been broken, little shards, and the names of everybody that was on Masada was written on one of those little pieces of pottery. And for the longest time, I understand it doesn't happen now, but the longest time, the Israeli Defense Force from 1948 till just recently, when they would go in to swear in to the army, which every man does and every woman does, woman for a short period of time, men do it for a long period of time, okay, they would go to Masada. They would stand on Masada and they would say, never again. So that happened in AD 70. That's when that happened. And they were taken out of the land. The Israelites, the Jewish people, were out of the land for almost 2,000 years. And then, as I said earlier, 1948. Okay. At the end of World War II. And interesting that God often used tragedies and horrible things in order to fulfill His purpose in the sense of reestablishing His people. So we know what happened in 1940. Prior to that, in World War II, 6 million Jews were put to death. And the worldwide government, if you will, decided that Israel needed a homeland, and they once again gave back this region, which again, I remind you, is about the size of New Jersey, or a whole nation. Okay? And then Israel started coming back. And I believe this is part of the prophecy that Zechariah is speaking about. It fits perfectly that he would speak about this, okay? So he says, I will bring them back because I have mercy on them, and they shall be as though I had not cast them aside, for I am the Lord their God, and I will hear them. Those of Ephraim shall be like a mighty man, and their heart shall rejoice as if with wine. Yes, their children shall see it and be glad, and their heart shall rejoice in the Lord. So this certainly not only speaks of a physical return, but I would say this carries on to a spiritual return. But it's interesting that, again, we look at the size of Israel. We look at the size of the Israeli army, which is small. Okay? But you look at the attacks that have happened since 1948, and particularly in the 60s, when all the nations from all the way around here decided they were going to come against Israel. And they thought they would destroy them. In 6 days, Israel defeated these huge nations. And not only did they defeat them, they took more land than they had before that time. Because before that time, Jerusalem was cut pretty much in two. Okay? After that time, Israel took all of Jerusalem back. Now, they have since given part of East Jerusalem back to the Palestinians. So if you ever go to Jerusalem, Jerusalem still is a divided city when it comes to that. But though the Palestinians are still in East Jerusalem, they still are under Israeli law. Okay? He promised that he'd bring them back. Ultimately, he's going to bring them back spiritually, where they will recognize God as being their God. But initially, they'll be brought back in unbelief. And that's where we are today. They are there in unbelief. They are not, certainly do not recognize Christ Jesus as a Messiah. And when it comes to God, they have a sense of God, mostly in the sense of tradition, religious tradition. There are some ultra-Orthodox groups. You've seen them, the Hasidic Jews. They wear the black all the time, and they have little curlicues and the beards and stuff like that. Don't call them curlicues when you go over there. But they're over there and stuff. And by the way, they don't want you there. That's probably the one Jewish group that does not want a bunch of Gentiles running through Israel. Well, I've been cursed by them and told not to come back, and we don't belong there and all that kind of stuff. For the most part, Israel is filled with secular, what would be called secular Jewry. They celebrate all their traditions. They even acknowledge Sabbath, because on Sabbath, Jerusalem is like a ghost town. There's no cars driving around. There's nothing like that. They have elevators in each of the big hotels called Shabbat elevators that you don't have to push the button. You get in one. If you're going to an odd floor, it stops at every odd floor. One stops at every even floor, so you don't have to push the button. Yeah, Sabbath day elevator. They have kosher kitchens and non-kosher kitchens. You never put a non-kosher dish into a kosher dishwasher. Once you do that, you've contaminated it. It's amazing. I mean, it's just amazing how they approach all of this and stuff. And most of it's from a, it sounds strange, from a secular perspective that's tied to religious tradition. Mary.
You had said earlier, God has brought them back into the land in unbelief, and you had made reference to that was a prophecy. Is there a particular scripture that talks about that?
About what?
Them being brought back into the land, but in unbelief.
Yeah, there is, and I can't remember where it is. I'll have to look up that for you. Someone needs to write me a note to remind me that, because I'm going to sleep between now and then.
I'll write you a note.
I'm good, thank you.
That's interesting that you say that, but it's very much here. When my son practices, we go to the Jewish Community Center. And so, just with the past, they did for 10 days, they closed down their entire kitchen because they cannot take any chance during that time of anything unkosher being
right
there. And it is just so interesting, and a lot of the kids that are there, you'll see them with their tzitzis, and they all wear their,
a little yarmulke and everything.
Because, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they play their games in it and everything. And,
mm-hmm.
So there's definitely, but then you have the secular Jews and the Hasidics all within the same thing, and it's very interesting when you talk with them.
Yeah. And it's very interesting when you go over there. In holy places, men wear head covers, the yarmulke, mm-hmm. or a hat. Mm-hmm. Okay? Women don't. You know, it's almost all, women, in our churches here, women will wear a hat. And men would never. We would think it'd be disrespectful for a man to wear a hat in church and stuff. But it's just the opposite over there. Matter of fact, when you go to the Western Wall and stuff, you go into what they consider the holy place where people are praying and stuff like that. They actually have paper yarmulkes right there. If you don't have a hat on as a man, you have to pick up one of those paper yarmulkes and put it on the back of your. I don't know how they keep that under all the time. I don't know. Maybe like when the kids were babies and stuff, didn't have much hair, you put Karo syrup and stick the bows on there. No hair to hold it, so you have to. Y'all never did that?
No.
Oh, well, you missed out on that one. Then when you kiss them on the head, you got a little sweet taste there.
So. I think you made that up.
No, I didn't. All right.
It's in Arizona.
Oh, yeah. It must be. So, verse 8, I will whistle for them and gather them, and I will redeem them. Isn't that an interesting picture? I will whistle for them. It's a call. You know, the word picture is that God is going to call them, and when he calls them, he's going to gather them. He's going to bring them back. Certainly, we have other instances in the Old Testament where they blow the shofar and the trumpets, if you will, and it would call the people. We carry that tradition even into our own history and stuff, where the Calvary and stuff had the thing. And even on military bases, even as late as 70, I don't know what they're doing now, but 70, every morning started with the reveille being played over the loudspeakers. And it, the day ended with the taps, and we would take the flag up when the reveille went down, we'd take the flag down when the taps went. And it was a speaker all over the thing, and then where I was stationed, I would pop the howitzer off at the lowering of the flag and stuff. I forgot to put the earplugs in, so that's why I don't hear very well today.
NIV says signal instead of
signal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My notes also amplify that a little bit, because today in our culture, to call somebody by a whistle, to call them to you, like, it's really kind of like a put down. You know?
Yeah.
Like you whistle for a dog, you know, whistle for people.
Yeah.
But they make reference to it being, that's what the shepherds did. They whistled to their sheep. As well as use their voices. And because it's a...
They recognize the shepherd's voice, yeah.
Yeah, right.
It's a great word picture. It is hard for us. We're westernized. I'm not a dog. Don't whistle at me, you know. And,
yeah.
Well, yeah, you are a dog, so you know, whistle this whistle. You know, anyways. For I will redeem them. And look at the last part of verse 8. And they will increase as they once increased. And we are in the midst of that time. By the way, there are still more Jewish people in America than there are in Israel. But they are starting to head back, you know. Verse 9, I will sow them among the peoples. And that could be reference to the dispersion that we're talking about that is still happening today. God is sowing them among the people. He's growing them among the people. And again, I've shared this with you before. God used the dispersion to do something for Israel that none of these countries around it have experienced. None of them. Now, the only country that's really experiencing this to any extent now is Jordan. Where you see Amman right here, Jordan, okay, modern-day Jordan. And that is because Israel is sharing with modern-day Jordan. That's because the king of Jordan is more progressive than the other Arab kings and nations, and he sees the advantage of technology and how to farm in the desert and all that kind of stuff. All this area around here is nothing but, you know, we were driving last time we came from over here in Egypt. We crossed the Sinai, we hit up the Sinai Peninsula and stuff, and once we crossed into the southern tip of Israel, the Israeli guide said to me, he said, "Well, you're from Arizona, you're used to this kind of desert." I said, "No, our desert is pretty. This is ugly." Because there's nothing there. I mean, when you talk about desert, that's the picture of desert. There's no, and we have beautiful plants and stuff out here and stuff. Over there, there is nothing. There is, when you talk about desolate desert, that's what that's like. But Israel now is pulling water out of the Mediterranean Sea. By the way, California could learn something from this or run out of water. They got a big pond of water right next to them called Pacific. But Israel is pulling water out of the Mediterranean Sea, taking the salt out of it, okay, and using it to Israel's green as it can be. It's a beautiful place. All this midsection of Israel now, it's feeding all of Israel. It's feeding part of Jordan, and they're teaching Jordan how to do all of this stuff. And they're pulling most of the water again out of the sea to do that. It's an incredible thing. And God took them out of that place and took them all around the world. And now some of the greatest scientists are Jewish scientists and monetary people. And I mean, when you go right down the line, doctors and all this kind of stuff, if they would have stayed in that region for the last 2,000 years, that would have never happened. They would be a third world country the same way that the others around them are. It's an amazing thing that God has done.
When you went there, did you ever go into a Jewish synagogue?
We went into ancient Jewish synagogues. We actually, up in Capernaum, there is a synagogue that Jesus would have been in, up there in Capernaum.
But you never went into a service? To a
modern service. The only service we went into that involved Jews was actually Messianic Jews. Christian Jews who've received Jesus Christ. We got to go one time into a celebration of Purim, and that was a blast. They have a good time at Purim. You know, it's a story of Esther and Mordecai and Haman and stuff, and they give these noisemakers and hats and all this stuff, and every time it says Mordecai, you cheer, and every time someone mentions Haman, you boo and hiss and all this kind of stuff. And then you have a big feast. That's good stuff.
But what I wondered, well, do the men and women sit separate?
In the ultra orthodox places, yes. In the Reform and conservative in synagogues don't. Reform certainly don't, because in some Reform synagogues you actually have female rabbis. Okay, you would never have a female rabbi in an ultra orthodox thing. So, yes, the guys in black and stuff like that, their wives would never sit with them. They would be separated like they were before. By the way, that's the way they were in the first century. When you read Paul's writing, when he talks about women, do not speak up and ask your husband at home and stuff like that, he's speaking of a tradition where the women sat on one side when they gathered, kind of like the Quakers, I guess, isn't it? Where the women sat on one side and the men sat on the other side. And the women were certainly welcome to listen, okay, but they were not welcome to speak out. And that tradition he was talking about. Now, some of that tradition carried over to the church, and some people thought that was a command of Paul's. It was a command in the sense of to make sure that you did not offend people unnecessarily. Okay, that's what he was trying to say, because people had come out of that tradition. So, all right. Verse 9, I will sow them among the peoples, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live together with their children, and they shall return. And I will also bring them back from the land of Egypt, and gather them from Assyria, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon. By the way, you know where all these places are today, these ancient names. Well, Egypt's still there, okay? Assyria is not called Assyria today. It is, the A has been dropped. It is Syria. Okay? So right above Israel right here. Oh, boy. I'll just have to do this. The top of Israel right here, okay? And it kind of goes like a big pie shape all the way down to there, okay? Egypt. Right along the coastline, just a little strip above Israel, is Lebanon. Just to the east of Lebanon, a bigger area over here, including what used to be the Golan Heights, used to be Syria. Okay? That would be Syria. So when he mentioned that, he mentioned to the south, to the direct north, and to the northeast is the reference here, okay, of these different places. And it says, until no more room is found for them. Now this is a very interesting statement that applies so much to modern day Israel. They have run out of room. Now, they have made agreements through the years concerning land to try to appease their enemies, to say, you know, we'll give you, if you don't do this, we'll give you some land and stuff like that. The problem is they don't have a whole lot of land to be given away. Again, I remind you, eight Israels will fit in the state of Arizona. So, you know, to give away that which you don't have is kind of hard to do. Plus, the population is growing. But I talked to a Christian missionary, a Jewish lady who was a Christian missionary over there, and she talked about, we think abortion is bad in America, and we think that certainly Israel would never do that to their own children, but they do. She said, Israel, on their own laws for abortion, have killed more Jewish babies. This is her words. More Jewish babies than Hitler ever did. And she told me, said, Pastor, if we wouldn't be killing our babies, there's no way we'd be even talking about giving land back, because the land would be full. So this abortion thing, this killing innocent babies, is a worldwide thing. You know, I went to the Crisis Pregnancy Center banquet the other day, and Ruth Graham spoke, Billy Graham's daughter and stuff, and it was just, she did a tremendous job. And she was just brutally honest and stuff. You know, sometimes we think they're quote Christian royalty and don't have any trouble and problems and stuff, but that family has been through it, and God has been faithful. But we were reminded at that meeting that since 1973, Roe versus Wade, just in America alone, there have been 60 million babies that have been put to death in their mother's womb. And it's kind of like good. If all of us were born, anybody here born after 1973? You weren't born after 73? Oh, okay. Well, we're all old then. Okay. So, but let's suppose we all were born after 1973. Well, I want you to see the ratio here. If we were all born after 1973, I would be here. You would be here. You would not. You would be here. You would be here. You would not. Every third person is not here in America because of abortion. That's a huge, when you start putting that together, you know, there are not enough people in, what they say, how they said it? They said pretty much California, Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, and one other state. You add up the population of all those states and touches That's the amount of people that have been killed in abortion since 1973. I mean, we start putting them in terms like that, you start seeing. So remember, for the Jewish mindset, it has always been that children were a blessing from the Lord. I mean, that's what's always been taught. Okay? And the more children you have, the more blessed you were. And so this statement to say, you will, when he says, I'm going to bring you back until there's no more room for them. Again, it's a statement that he's going to, it's a statement of blessing. It's a statement that you're going to have children and your population is going to grow. And isn't it interesting how the world has turned around that's not how we see that anymore? You know, you gave the illustration of the Dugard family or Dugard, however you want to say it. But I know Christians that get all upset at them. You know, because they do not practice any kind of birth control or anything like that. It's an interesting thing how if we're not careful, we let the world shape the way we view what's valuable and what's important. So you're going to bring them back from all that place so there's no more room. Verse 11, by the way, we're already there. There's no more room. Everybody got that? There's no more room. But remember this, they are not in this day, they are not in the promised borders that God told David that they would have, or Moses. They've not expanded those borders yet. You shall pass through the sea with affliction and strike the waves of the sea, and all the depths of the river shall dry up, and the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart. So these two that have been historic enemies of Israel, God will remove. By the way, we're seeing that already. What power does Egypt have today? None. You know who supplies Egypt and Syria with their military? We do. Now, they do get some things from Iran and stuff like that, but most of those are not, listen, most of those are not official, and from Russia, those are not official things given to the government. They are mostly given to the subversives within the government. That's how ISIS is supplied. That's how these radical Muslim groups are equipped. But it's interesting what we have done as a country. We supply Israel, and we supply Israel's enemies. So the Egyptians and the Syrians are flying the same planes as the Israelis because they come from us. Now, you just have to be honest about this. We manipulate that. We manipulate the amount of technology in those planes. The plane from the outside may look the same, but they do not all have the same technology. They do not all have the... Certainly, we equip Israel with weaponry that we do not equip Egypt with or Syria with. We equip them, but not with the same weaponry. Part of the quote, diplomacy, if you want to put it that way, is to keep things balanced in the Middle East. But you see, when radical groups arrive, they throw the balance off.
Right.
And then you got all kinds of issues, which where we are today. But a lot of people, a lot of Americans are, well, yeah, we support Israel. And you'll hear people say, well, we need to quit supporting Israel and just support the Palestinians. People don't realize we're supporting them all. There's not a group over there we're not supporting. We're helping the Jordanians too.
Borrowing money from China to do it.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's right. So, yeah. You're exactly right. You know, people say, well, we shouldn't be the world. We are the world's policemen. Okay. And we've tried a couple of areas. We're trying in Afghanistan till this day. We tried in Iraq. We try to deport our way of looking at life, which includes a democracy or a public system of government. And we think if we just import that or deport that to them, that they'll be like us. The reality is they don't want that. They don't see the world the same way that we do. And it's a mistake to think that what we do here is what they need there. Do we need stability there? Of course we do. But, you know, so often we Americans think everybody has to be exactly like us or the world can't function. Mm-hmm. You know, and by the way, the Christian church has done that for decades. We go into these regions, we go into Africa and stuff, and we will make these good little African kids a bunch of little American kids. They are not American kids, they're African kids. But the gospel is big enough to touch them in their society. We don't have to make them into Americans to make them Christians. That was a big thing about the evangelical movement around the world. And we thought we're going there and we're going to put American missionaries there and they're going to spend their whole lives there. When what we should have done is sent the American missionaries there, trained their people, equipped their people, and then get out of the way. Anyways, that's my little mission statement. We'll move on from there.
We are
doing it better now. Where we don't put somebody over there and act like the great white hope. You know, we do go over there, train, equip, and stuff, and help support. But let local pastors pastor their people. which is the way I think the church is supposed to expand. All right. Verse 12. And I will strengthen them in the Lord, and they shall walk up and down in His name, says the Lord. That term walk up and down just simply means they'll walk in security and freedom and without fear of threat. It speaks of a time of peace. You know when you feel like you can do that. Places that you feel, you know, even in here in America, there are places you feel like, I could do that. And there are places that I would never do that. It's just, and that's the promise that He has. All right. Chapter 11 moves to a new theme, and the theme of chapter 11 I think chapter 11 is going to, through the rest of the book, is going to talk about God's plan through Messiah, tied with Israel. But how did Israel respond to Messiah the first time? They rejected him. They rejected him. As I said, to this day, for the most part, Jewish people do not recognize Jesus as Messiah. He's not Messiah to them. Okay? There are certainly Jewish people of Jewish heritage that have put their faith in Messiah. We call them Messianic Jews or Messianic believers. Some people use the term completed Jews. But the point is that there are those who have put their faith in Jesus Christ. But for the most part, they have not. And they do not see Jesus as Messiah. They are still waiting for Messiah, which is the reason I believe that when Antichrist comes initially, Israel will believe that he possibly could be Messiah to them. And for at least the first 3.5 years, they will follow him, believing him to be Messiah. He'll have all, quote, the answers. So, go ahead. Yes,
sorry,
Sunday, go ahead.
Let's go back. I just know that we skipped this one verse. But can you help me out with who the scepter of Egypt would be? In 10:11 it says, and the scepter of Egypt will depart.
Scepter speaks of authority and power. The scepter is a thing that a king holds in his hand.
Right.
Okay? And it speaks that scepter is representative of the power, the authority of the king and the power. You remember when Esther was going to come before the king, the law was if he didn't extend his scepter to you, that you actually could be put to death if you came in the presence of the king without his permission. So it speaks, that scepter speaks of complete authority. By the way, the prophecy earlier in the Old Testament is that the scepter will not go out of the hand of Judah until Messiah comes. Speaking of authority. So the authority of Egypt, which historically has been huge, particularly in relation to Israel. You look at the history of Israel, particularly just prior to that. They're back in the land now, but you remember prior to during the time when Babylon had taken them away and Jeremiah was here in the land and stuff, and there was still a remnant in the land and stuff, and they went up to Jeremiah and said, Jeremiah, tell us what we should do. And Jeremiah said, here's what God says. Don't trust Egypt. So what did the Jewish people do? They trust Egypt. And because they did, and they went down into Egypt, thinking Egypt would protect them, and then the Babylonians came down and took over Egypt too. So the statement there is, Egypt really has not been a world power since that time. The scepter has been removed. They do not have the power that they once had. They were once a worldwide leader. Matter of fact, they were a worldwide leader prior to the time when we studied Daniel, all the different world systems, starting with Babylon and then the Medo-Persian and the Greek and then the Romans. Egypt's not mentioned there, nor is Assyria, because both of those were pre-Daniel. Daniel was looking prophetically in the future. But I want you to remember, prior to Daniel, you think about the world leaders, prior to Daniel's message, the two world leaders that we have in the scripture were Assyria, the Assyrians, which were for a long time, and then the other world leader that we had was Egypt. And by the way, who raised Egypt up? God did. Who did God use to help raise Egypt up?
Joseph.
A man by the name of Joseph. So he raised them up to a world power, and that they at one time they were the power here. Same way the Assyrians were the power here for one time, but they're gone. By the way, and the prophecy, they'll never regain that again. The scepter's gone. They'll never have that kind of authority again. That's what he's talking about. Yes.
In referring to the verses that Sandy was just mentioning, from a previous study, I have a reference to Daniel 11, which is about a lot about judgment. It's very much full of prophecy
and so forth. Right. Verse 11 is tied with a lot with verses 10 and 11 here. Excuse me. Chapter 11 of Daniel is tied with verses 10 and 11 here, and talks about those very nations. And I know you remember when we went through that. We talked about the kings of the north. It has a lot to do with the time of those who followed Alexander and his generals and the fight over the Holy Land and stuff. Okay. All right. Now, chapter 11. He says, "Open your doors, O Lebanon, that fire may devour your cedars. Well, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen, because the mighty trees are ruined. Well, O oaks of Bashan, for the thick forest has come down." This is so interesting, because if you go over there today, they talk about how this used to be a wonderfully forested place. By the way, if you look at the flag of Lebanon, what's on the flag of Lebanon?
A tree.
A huge tree.
Yes.
Okay. You go to Lebanon today, you would be hard pressed to find forest. Israel has been so overcome by trees that they are reforesting Israel. That's why they have people buy trees and plant them in Israel in people's memories and stuff like that, or as a blessing to Israel. They're bringing in the trees. But it's interesting, he talks about this, the cypress and the cedar has fallen. And again, the big thing at that time was the cedars of Lebanon, okay, and a mighty cedar, and the picture that he gives here is that they are no more. The cypress tree, those are, by the way, Israel's planted a whole lot of those. There used to be a marshland there. They're very quick growing and stuff, and they sucked up the water out of the marshland. It was interesting. You can see them over there, where they just acres and acres of these trees that they planted in rows to suck up the moisture out of the marshland. When they finished that, guess what was left there? Some of the best farmland in all the world. From all that marshland being there for all that time. Okay, so all these regions around Israel that were regions of plenty and prosperous, and they used the forest to speak of those things, he says that day is going to cease. And by the way, that day, you don't want to spend too much time in Lebanon. You ever heard of the name Beirut? I mean, do you have any good connotations of that word Beirut?
No.
I lived in Beirut.
Did you? What years was that?
The mid-60s.
Mid-60s. So that was prior to a lot of the trouble. What was it like there then?
It was wonderful. We had no fear of anything. And we were evacuated during the Six-Day War.
Six-Day War. Mm-hmm. That we just referred to. Mm-hmm. And from pretty much from the Six-Day War on, Beirut has just been... It sounds bad, but Lebanon and Beirut just seem... It seems like it's a... It just went out of my head. A range. What I mean, the army has these ranges where they test missiles, and that's Beirut and Lebanon's been like, it's where everybody's launching missiles in there. Mm-hmm. The city of Beirut is just, it's just devastated.
When we left at the airport, there were all kinds of machine guns and everything everywhere.
And you'll probably remember the embassy bombing when Reagan was a president and stuff like that. Was 400 something of our people were killed and that stuff. And it's just Beirut, and Lebanon said, I've sat on the border between Israel and Lebanon, and they have a fence on Israeli side, they have a fence on the Lebanese side, and they have a road that goes down there, and Israeli troops patrol that road all day long. They're not 60 seconds apart. The Humvees and stuff. The American Humvees that are going up and down that thing right there. So it is quite fascinating. You see the geopolitical impact of all of this, and then you tie it to what I mean, we're talking about over 2,000 years ago, God said this would be like this. So, Mary.
Just an interesting story again about Lebanon, about Beirut. In 1999, when I was over there, my brother was manager of the Nazareth Marriott. And he was good friends with the manager of the Beirut, Lebanon Marriott. who would make agreements with the armies, the military people out there, for the hours that they would shoot because it was disrupting his tourism. This is a modern view of war. Oh boy.
Yeah. When I go over there, I try to go to a different country every time I go, including Israel. So I'm not going to Lebanon, so not now. We'll go to Jordan, but we're not going to Lebanon, so. All right, so verse 3, and there is a sound of wailing. There is a sound of wailing shepherds. There's a reference here again to Jeremiah chapter 25 here, the wailing shepherds, those who. You can look at it this way: those whose leadership should have been a blessing to the people and brought the people into prosperity and blessing, but they themselves have become so corrupt that they look around and they see they look around and see the fruit of their ministry. And the fruit of ministry is either good or it's bad. You know? I don't know. This wailing, some people would say this wailing speaks of shepherds who have seen that they've led the people in the wrong way and now their heart is broken because of that. I don't see that. I'm more cynical than that. So I don't see this as a wailing that they regret what they did. I think it is a wailing that they're not getting everything they thought they would get.
For yeah. The glory is in ruins.
Right.
Their glory, they're mourning.
Yeah, and the pride of Jordan is in ruins. So, thus saith the Lord of God, feed the flock for slaughter. Wow. Who's feeding the flock? Well, the shepherds feeding the flock. And what are these bad shepherds they're feeding their flock? Not for glory, not for prosperity, not for the blessings of God, but actually for slaughter. Whose owners slaughter them and feel no guilt. Those who sell them say, blessed be the Lord, for I am rich, and their shepherds do not pity them. So, a couple of things here. These false shepherds either put forth or believe themselves that they're doing the work of God. It ought to sound familiar to you today. In the name of religion, or in the name of God, in the name of Allah, whatever term you want to use there, what you have is people who think they're doing the work of God. But in the midst of doing the work of God, they're sacrificing the very people that God has called to lead. Okay? Most of you know me, I served in the military and stuff, and you know my feeling about those things. But I think before our Congress or anybody sends any of our young people to battle, they better make sure that's a battle that needs to be fought. You don't just send young people over there to send them over there. And I believe, again, I honor the country, and the flag is a wonderful thing to me. And all, you know, really, it makes me mad when people disrespect it and stuff like that. But at the same time, it ought to be a very sobering and a very heart-wrenching thing to ever say to the young people of our country, we're going to have to send you over somewhere. When it gets to a place where we can just send them and say, well, we lost so many today and stuff, we're not much different than what he's describing here. And certainly when we talk about those people in the Middle East that would strap bombs on the backs of their young men and then send them into a place and say, go die for the glory of Allah, it's very clear here. And we sit back and say, well, you know, that doesn't even make sense. But we need to make sure we don't do that also. It ought to be a very hard thing. I just want to show it ought to be the hardest thing we ever do is to send our young people into a place. I understand and I agree there are times that it needs to happen. I fully agree with that. But it ought to be a very, very hard thing for us to do before we do that.
Is that a major resistance to the Vietnam War? Is that they were just sending our young men in there dying, just... sending more bodies.
Yeah, and I served with a lot of those guys, and the problem with that was it wasn't just a matter of going in there and battling and stuff. It was a matter of take that hill, then give it back. Or come to this line and don't cross that line. We made talk about hours of shooting between Lebanon and this other. Here's a line right here. You don't cross this line. Even if you're winning the war, you don't cross the line. You stop right there. So it got to the place of being ridiculous. And certainly the tide of public opinion turned because of that kind of approach. It started really in Korea. it carried on in Vietnam, that we had that kind of approach to warfare. I mean, war is ugly, it's horrible, and it ought to be a very serious thing when you do it. But when you decide to do it, you need to go do it. And then you know, if you have to do it, you need to go do it and not play games with people's lives. Anyway, that's the end of that little speech right there. But so he talks about this. He says their shepherds did not pity them. They used them as human fodder. Okay. It goes on to say, verse 6, "For I will no longer pity the inhabitants of the land, says the Lord, but indeed I will give everyone into his neighbor's hand, and in the hand of his king they shall attack the land, and I will deliver them from their hand." Okay? So, he is talking about a time of judgment. He's talking about a time of severity. Now, when could this be? Certainly it could be, and I'm just about running out of time. Certainly this could be if we're looking into the future. There will be a time again, and I personally think it's going to be more in the tribulation time, but there's nothing that can say that there won't be an attack on Israel before the tribulation time. Okay, there's nothing to say that's not. What it does say is Israel will not cease to exist. So their plan to destroy Israel will not come about. But that doesn't mean there won't be an attack on Israel. And that doesn't mean that it might not be a severe attack. And it gives this picture. And the shepherds he speaks of here are those who should be leading this nation in the way of the Lord, but are not. And there are consequences. There are some people who say, well, it doesn't seem like there's any real consequences for Israel today being in unbelief. Yes, there is. There is. And there will be. But once again, it doesn't mean that God's not going to use them. It doesn't mean that God's not going to restore them. It doesn't mean that God's not going to reveal himself. He'll do all of those things. But it's going to happen, you know, it's going to happen during troublesome times, not during, you know, peace and you know, we get to say nobody can touch Israel. Well, that's not what the Bible says. It doesn't say nobody can touch Israel. It says that God will not take his hand off them or let them be destroyed. But that doesn't mean we're not going to see attacks on Israel. We very may well. And I think Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39 will be the culmination of those attacks. And God will step forward for Israel in that time. But there are going to be other things before that, I believe. And I have to stop there. Questions or comments for you?